There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
Here at Max Mike Records, for a limited time only, we're offering up the original off-Broadway cast album of the family-friendly, feel-good musical Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Oddity. Who can forget these incredible hits? Open up those pod bay doors, let me in right now. Sorry, Dave, but that I just can't allow. Or who could forget? There's a star child. Boy, is that intense. We'd like to know the ending, but it don't make that much sense. And of course, Daisy, Daisy, look who I've killed for you. These and many, many more. Want to order a copy? Of course you do. And you can get your own vinyl, 8-track, or polyphonic femtosecond laser sphere, all for the low, low price of 4,500 proof of purchase tabs from your favorite Bumpy Puck cereal. Try new frosted Bumpy Pucks. Just don't ask what they're frosted with. And act now before our series didn't win, is over. Get your parents' permission. Not available in all states. Sorry, Tennessee. Some albums may be made out of chicken. I'm your host, Max the Mysterious Monolith Levine. And over there, hovering in the airless void of space, is Mike the Troubled Star Teen Loose. Lay some cosmic angst on us, Star Teen.
What did you drink, eat, or smoke? And you have an antidote.
I don't know. I found them growing underneath the cabinet, and they're making me taste colors.
I bet they are, among other things. What the hell did you watch? Because I know singing.
Well, it should have been.
No.
That's why it didn't get nominated for Best Picture, but we'll come back to that.
Yes.
But first, we've got to know about...
Poll question.
Last time we asked you, or told you, that we would really like to know, what is your favorite performance by Samuel L. Jackson? The L stands for Linguini.
It doesn't.
You don't know that?
Are you going to get anything right this week?
Do I ever?
Kinda.
Aha! Run rings around you logically, haven't
I? Oh, I feel so much better.
Brian Mundo says, the one where he got those monkey-fighting snakes off that Monday to Friday plane. Somebody watch the TV or airplane cut.
Snakes on a plane.
Uh-huh. Regan McStravick says, I like when he got eaten by the shark. You could narrow it down a little. I assume that's Deep Blue Sea.
Ah.
Jamie Kleinert says, Charles Moritz in The Red Violin.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know that. I've never seen that. Not a big part, but crucial to the story being told, and I can't imagine it being played by anyone else.
Huh. Yeah, I think it came out the same year as Run, Lola, Run. Yeah, it was an indie film. It didn't get a lot of play, but I actually did see it. I honestly don't remember that much because it was like 1999. It was a long time ago.
Tyler Stewart simply says, Pulp Fiction. Yeah, hard to argue with that. Nick Hoffman says, such a difficult question. His performances in Tarantino's films alone would be a hard one to quantify. He's really indelible. So he's a stain. Okay.
No.
Or ink. That's what indelible means. If I had to pick one, it would have to be Pulp Fiction, because his line deliveries are unforgettable. That is true. The Bible verse, tasty beverage, that's just a classic. Yeah. Yep. It really put him on the map in a very big way.
That's what Dave Meiselman is unforgettable. If you can sing, I can sing.
Yeah. Who said I could sing?
Oh, right.
Yeah,
you got
Dave
me there.
Meiselman also says, favorite is definitely Pulp Fiction for all of the classic lines. Most noteworthy for me, however, was his role as Wesley Snipes' brother in Jungle Fever. Oh, another Spike Lee movie.
Mm.
That's when I first noticed him because he was so good.
Hmm.
Roland Hardy, another vote for Pulp Fiction.
Uh-oh.
A.J. Shems. It's Shems, right?
I've heard Shems.
Okay, Shems. I don't know, sir. This might be your first ever objective Sunday poll question. Because there is no answer other than Pulp Fiction. Huh. Well, the majority is on your side, A.J. Although he's brilliant in all of his work, Jules Winfield, to me, is the most memorable on-screen character ever. Looking forward to this episode. Sorry, he's not actually in this movie that we're doing today.
No, there's literally not a single person of color in this film.
Yeah,
but we'll get to... Well, I guess we did.
Adam Mark, the master of brevity, said, "A wealth of choices. I agree that Pulp Fiction, 1994, is his opus. It's a story of biblical-esque fables, a powerhouse of performances, but no one who's seen it can depart the theater without Jackson's performance haunting their thoughts. I will say, for the sake of variety, that his breakout performance in Jurassic Park, 1993, as Ray Arnold, sarcastic and fed up, but also very capable and knowledgeable, is very memorable. A throwaway role written specifically to be forgotten, he shines. No one can make hurried typing on a computer while muttering with a cigarette butt in your mouth look so engaging like Samuel L. Jackson. A pity his exit scene is his severed arm falling on Laura Dern's shoulder, but hey, snakes on a plane, man." Very good points.
Sure.
Val Coons, known to the world as the leader, mistress, and high doyen of Q Footsteps.
Is there a low doyen?
There is indeed, and we don't talk about her. Says, "Movie-wise, I think Jurassic Park would be on top, followed by The Avengers. He was also in a kids' PBS TV show I really liked called Ghost Rider." Hey, kids, how the poop are you?
No.
"About kids solving mysteries with the help of this little ghost character. It was fun." Huh, I don't know that one.
You know Ghost Rider? Oh, yeah, my niece really loved that show.
I thought that was one with Nicolas Cage.
No.
Peeing fire.
Rider. This is Rider.
Oh. Dr. Professor Rebecca Pelkey says, "I've always really enjoyed Die Hard with a Vengeance." Ah, yes, where he plays Zeus.
Well, somebody has to.
Yep. Matthew Reisman just says, "Frozone!" Where he asks the question that's on all our minds, "Where is my super suit?" Mr. Skipper Doo.
Who is Mr. Skipper Doo?
That's a deep cut. Yep. And, of course, representing all those Samuel L. Jackson fans out on the great frozen tundra, Vince says, "Samuel L. Jackson is a good actor and fun in so many roles, but when he plays Nick Fury, I am all in for it. Unbreakable is probably his best serious role for me." Okay, where he plays Mr. Glass.
Mm.
Interesting. Okay, some good answers. Mike, what's your favorite Samuel L. Jackson role?
I have one. It's, let's see. It's that one where he's the guy, remember, when he's... he's so good in that.
Couldn't think of one, huh?
No. When I saw Matt's answer and he said Frozone, I was like, yeah, I really liked him as Frozone. I know it's just a voice, but the character is... quite honestly, so much more interesting than Mr. Incredible. I mean, it's Mr. Incredible's journey, and I gotta say, The Incredibles is...
I would like to go bowling, for real!
The Incredibles is a great film. I mean, it's basically superheroes and James Bond done really, really well. And I think the real star of that film is the mom. I mean, she puts up with so much, but he has a smaller role in that, but I like it. I think that I... And nobody said Star Wars, which surprised me.
It didn't surprise me. He's so boring in that.
I know, but you're just hoping he'll go crazy. And he
doesn't. Yeah, but he doesn't. what's so frustrating.
I'm not saying that's one of my favorites. I'm just surprised nobody mentioned it. I would probably go with Nick Fury. I think partially because they took, if I remember correctly, in the comics, was this where they decided to change who Nick Fury was and somebody drew
him? It was in
him?
the ultimate universe. That's they based him on Samuel L. Jackson.
And then
Jackson,
they were like, let's just hire him. Nick Fury, let's face it, was yet another of Marvel's big corral of pasty white characters. And they took him and just... Thankfully, they didn't write his character in the movie the way, say, I don't know, the original writers and artists of Marvel would write black characters in the 70s. I'm looking at you, Black Racer. Ugh.
Yeah.
And he just...
Or Power Man, Luke Cage.
So sweet Christmas.
He has that great line, I think it's the first Avengers movie, says, "Yes, I'm aware of the council's decision, but seeing as it is a stupid-ass decision, I have chosen to ignore it." It's like, nobody else could deliver that line that well, that perfectly.
Well, let's just face it. I just like Samuel L. Jackson in anything. I am not a fan, as we have heard in episode whatever, for Pulp Fiction, that I'm not a fan of Pulp Fiction. I'm not a fan of Tarantino at all. But there's like no bad performances by Samuel L. Jackson. So it's a tough one. But this was my question. So how would you answer it? And don't sing.
Well, I'll tell you.
No! Stop it! Stop it! No, that will arm you.
One of them is Nick Fury. I do think he just is, he inhabits the character. He, in effect, it's like he recreates the character.
He makes it more and interesting. Makes it his own.
And it's, yeah. The original Nick Fury, even back when he was in the Howling Commandos, wahoo, wasn't, as a person, wasn't that interesting. This character is fascinating.
Well, he smoked a cigar.
Yes. He smoked a cigar and eventually had one eye. And he's from Brooklyn, I think.
And he had a friend named Dum Dum.
Actually, no, he's not. That was
everyone was from Brooklyn. Everyone was from
But one of the parts I really liked him in is just because it was so different was from Kingsman: The Secret Service.
Oh,
where he plays, I can't even remember the character's name. He is the bad guy. And he is, you know, a megalomaniac, but he's the least badass you could be. He throws up at the sight of blood. He hates violence. He can't. He's physically freaks him out.
Is that like the third Kingsman movie?
No, it was the first one.
Oh, first. Okay, I never saw the first one. Did it? No, I only saw the second one. Isn't that weird?
Oh,
I don't know
that
why.
That is odd. First one, I like a lot. I think it's very well done, and it's fun seeing, you know, Colin Firth as a badass because. Those words do not usually appear in the same, I don't know, paragraph, possibly script. Even narrative. Yeah. But yes, but those were all terrific answers. Yay. Thank you so much. And now I'd like to ask you this. Inspired by, I don't know what. Do you think the bias against genre movies like science fiction or westerns is unfair? Or do you think it's right for award nominations to go mostly to so-called real movies?
Mm.
And we will tell you how to answer that question for both of you who don't know at the end of the show.
Yeah, as soon as I figure out how to encapsulate that into something I can get into Facebook.
It's just one sentence. I can send it to you. It's just kind of long. No.
We'll see.
No, it's two.
I like it to have the color. I like the color.
Mm-hmm. But now we need to get to... facts. Budget, $12 million.
Ooh, that's a lot.
This is 1968. That's big money. Now, the worldwide gross, and I'll get to this in a second, ultimately was $66
million. Yeah, ultimately.
However, the movie was not a financial success at first. MGM was going to pull it back from theaters, but a bunch of theater owners persuaded them to keep showing it. Many owners noticed increasing numbers of young adults attending the film. They were especially enthusiastic about watching the Stargate sequence under the influence of, happy pills.
What?
Yeah, this is what helped the film to become a financial success. Come on, it's 68. All the hippies are going in tripping balls on psychedelic cat boluses or whatever they were doing.
Huh? Well, that wasn't Tide Pods.
That was what made it such a success.
Hmm.
And it's still around. It still shows up as a midnight movie in some places.
Ooh, bad timing.
Okay, let's address the very small elephant in the room. Yes, if you letter shift Hal's name, H-A-L, one letter each, goes from it becomes IBM. Both Kubrick and Sir Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote the screenplay and the book, say no, that's nonsense. Kubrick said the computer's name is an acronym for heuristic and algorithmic, HAL, the two methods of computer programming, in his words. Seeing the IBM acronym in those letters would have taken a cryptographer, he said. But some people think it's a little disingenuous. Consider that Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote the film and wrote the novel at the same time, he had just seen an IBM 704 computer make history with the first known recording of a computer-synthesized voice. Guess what the song was?
I'm going to go with Daisy.
Yeah, it's actually Daisy Bell. But yep.
Oh.
Clark decided to have Hal sing the same song as he devolved. So, officially no, but coincidence?
Yes, apparently you just told us it was.
Maybe. Or did I?
Yeah, it was here!
That's what you want to think. Stanley Kubrick cut 19 minutes from the film's original 158-minute running time.
Wow.
After its New York premiere, mostly to speed up the pacing.
We'll
talk about that. According to Douglas Trumbull's, the total footage shot was almost 200 times the length of the final film.
Yeah, that's Kubrick.
Yeah. He apparently is legendary for doing 50 or 60 takes of scenes he really wants to get right.
Yeah.
The initial idea for the device that would eventually become the Black Monolith involved a transparent screen which would show the Australopithecines how to use objects as tools and weapons. Sir Arthur C. Clarke later dismissed it as, quote, too naive, unquote. Also, the HAL 9000 computer started out as a mobile robot, but as Clarke feared that this view of artificial intelligence would become hopelessly outdated in the coming decades, the omnipresent Red Eye was conceived. Good call.
I think that he would find he was mistaken. Have you seen some of those robot dogs? Some of them with flamethrowers?
Yeah, I've seen them. Buy? They breathe fire! Fire!
Yeah, we're going to be talking about AI this week.
According to Arthur Clarke again, Stanley Kubrick wanted to get an insurance policy from Lloyd's of London to protect himself against losses in the event that extraterrestrial intelligence was discovered before the movie was released. Lloyd's refused. Carl Sagan, a.k.a. the Butthead Astronomer, commented, quote, in the 1960s, there was no search being performed for extraterrestrial intelligence, and the chances of accidentally stumbling on it were extremely small. Lloyd's of London missed a good bet.
Why did you call him a Butthead Astronomer?
That's a deep cut. I'm surprised that you don't know that, Apple boy. There was a period, I think it was back in the 80s, when, you know how Apple would use code names for their operating system? They used to use famous people's names. There was Copeland, Joplin, a few others. One time they wanted to use Sagan as the name, and Carl Sagan sent them a cease and desist letter.
Okay.
Said, you can't use my name. So they renamed, if the code name they used in-house was Butthead Astronomer.
Oh. Well, don't call me Appleboy either. So there.
Okay, pear lad.
My name's Basher, or Pike, or one of those things.
Kubrick worked for months with effects technicians to come up with a convincing effect for the floating pen in the shuttle sequence. They tried all sorts of stuff. Eventually, he just used a pen that was adhered using this strange new invention called double-sided tape to a sheet of glass and held it in front of the camera. In fact, if you look closely, you can see the shuttle attendant sort of pulling the pen off the glass when she grabs it.
Hey, it worked for me. I didn't know how the hell they did it.
Yep, no idea. I thought it was amazing. At the premiere screening, 241 people walked out of the theater, including Rock Hudson.
Oh, well.
Who said, will someone tell me what the hell this is about?
Yeah, Rock Hudson. There's a meter for taste.
Sir Arthur C. Clarke once said, if you understand 2001 completely, we failed. Yeah. As you may have noticed, there is no dialogue in the first 25 minutes of the movie. It ends when the stewardess speaks at 25:38, nor in the last 23 minutes.
I beg to differ. The first 25 minutes does have dialogue, and I will quote, ook, 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 ook.
Roar, growl.
Splutter, snore.
With these two lengthy sections and a bunch of shorter ones, there are almost 88 dialogue-free minutes in this movie. According to his daughter, Katerina, Stanley Kubrick provides the breathing noises you hear in the spacesuits. So that's genuine Kubrickian.
Wow. Movie magic.
The film critic Andrew Saris gave the movie a negative review when it came out, and one of the things he didn't like about it was the clipped, almost militaristic way that the astronauts spoke to each other. Later, after the Apollo 11 moon landing, he said he'd been wrong because the real astronauts who landed on the moon spoke in exactly that clipped, almost militaristic way.
What a surprise.
Nice of him to fess up.
Yeah.
The only Oscar won by this film, and we'll come back to this, was for special visual effects. It was awarded to Stanley Kubrick, and that is his only win from 13 nominations.
Wow.
I should point out, and a number of the technicians pointed this out, he designed a lot of the look of the film and its effects. Many of the technicians didn't like that he got sole credit.
Yeah.
After this controversy, the Academy tightened the eligibility rules.
So there.
One of Kubrick's additions to the screenplay from Clark, which Clark didn't like at the time, was the HAL's ability to read the astronaut's lips when they're inside the pod. Years later, he said Kubrick had been right all along, especially after learning that at the time, computers had developed the ability to read lips. That's unsettling.
They did?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Back in the late 60s, early 70s.
I'm turning my camera off.
The sun and crescent moon aligned with each other in the opening shot is a symbol of Zoroastrianism. It's an old Persian religion that predates Buddhism and Christianity. This was one of the first monotheistic religions other than Judaism. Zoroaster is also known as Zarathustra.
Ah, that's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah. This particular alignment symbolizes the eternal struggle between light and darkness. And of course, the Space Odyssey theme is Also Sprach Zarathustra, Thus Spake Zarathustra, the symphonic poem by Richard Strauss, based on a book by Friedrich Nietzsche, which contained his famous declaration, God is dead. Later written, Nietzsche is dead, God.
Nietzsche is peachy.
Yes, but Sartre is smarter. One can assume, given Kubrick's working methods, that none of this was accidental.
What?
This was the last movie made about men on the moon before Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked there in real life. More than 50 years later, there are still theorists who insist that this is not a coincidence, that claiming that all the footage of Armstrong's voyage was a hoax directed by Kubrick using leftover scenes and props from this movie.
No.
See our series on conspiracy.
Oh, yeah. Hangar 18.
Yeah. Originally, Stanley Kubrick wanted legendary manga creator Osamu Tezuka to do some of the art direction after watching Astro Boy.
Tezuka.
However, Tezuka had to turn the offer down because of transporting issues from Japan to the UK. After the film's release, Tezuka told Kubrick he loved the movie and listens to the soundtrack while doing his own work.
Apparently he likes German music, because there's lots of it.
Sir Arthur C. Clarke first became aware of the project when he got the following cable from Roger Karras at MGM. Stanley Kubrick, Dr. Strangelove, Paths of Glory, etc., interested in doing film on ETs. Stop. Are you interested? Query. Thought you were recluse. Stop. Clarke replied with the following cable. Frightfully interested in working with Enfant Terrible. Stop. Contact my agent. Stop. What makes Kubrick think I'm a recluse? Query.
A spider? He's a small brown spider?
Yep, and he causes necrosis.
Ugh.
Although it's commonly believed that the famous jump cut from the bone being tossed into the air to the object floating in space, that is not a spaceship. It is a nuclear device circling the Earth.
Oh.
So the bone being used as the first murder weapon is thrown to become the ultimate weapon.
And we would know this because...
it's in the book.
Oh, right, the book.
Which was being written at the same time. There's one little cameo. The little girl who plays Dr. Floyd's daughter is Vivian Kubrick, the daughter of Stanley Kubrick.
It's just weird because I keep thinking of Kubrick as a Brit, and because a lot of his stuff was done in Britain, blah, blah, blah. And he isn't. He's an American. So why is his daughter got a British accent, I guess? Maybe his wife is British.
There is a metric ton of other trivia about this movie.
Oh, there is not.
Yes, there is. But we're going to stop now.
Because
it's time for...
There's no pause there. It's all part of the same segment.
Oh, sorry.
Listen to our show.
No.
I know.
You're kidding. That dweeb with the beard, I'm not listening to him. Those of you looking at the graphic, that's me. Sorry, did you have anything? Do you have any trivia that you wanted to bring in?
No, not that I need to bring in. I would just... Mm-hmm. No, it's fine. Mm-hmm. Nope. Mm-hmm.
It may also come in organically.
Sure.
So, the plot. It's 4 million years ago. We're all a bunch of damn dirty apes. When, hey presto, a giant licorice-flavored Pop-Tart, the monolith, appears, and touching it imparts incredible knowledge to a band of Australopithecuses.
Sigh.
Hitting things with other things is cool. From there, we jump straight to nuclear weapons and interplanetary travel, and what's all this? The same black monolith has been dug up on the moon. Is it the same monolith? Is it Monolith 2, son of monolith? No time to figure out, because son of monolith is sending a signal to Jupiter, so it's off to Jupiter in the Discovery 1 for Doctors Bowman and Poole, plus their three cryo-frozen colleagues and their trusty, reliable, utterly sane artificial intelligence, HAL 9000. They've got to find where that signal's going. Why? There's no time for that now. Although, given how slowly most stuff happens here, looks like HAL may not be the perfect AI that everyone thought he was because, oh dear, someone forgot to install the Don't Murder People software patch in poor HAL.
That is an upgrade you did not ask for?
Yeah, that's an opt-in you have to do. And whoopsie-doodle, he goes on a killing spree until only Bowman is left to demand that the pod bay doors be opened so he can control-alt-delete HAL, while HAL sings a plaintive old vaudeville song. Take that, you naughty AI! That'll teach you to plagiarize other people's artwork. But great googly moogly, we've made it to Jupiter, and there's Monolith 3, the revenge of Monolith, orbiting Jupiter, and the next thing Bowman knows, he's getting pure uncut Strauss music shot directly into his veins and goes on the mother of all drug trips for almost half an hour, where he grooves on wild colors, gets to see the really awesome apartment he might live in the future, and finally turns into a giant space fetus because why not? The end. The film.
Wow. Did you see the film?
I did indeed.
I'm not sure.
And my summation is flawless.
This is still that comedy musical thing that you wanted to see so much, isn't it?
Nope.
Gee, I wonder if Max liked the film. Anyway, Max, do you remember the first time you saw this film?
Oh, boy. No, I don't. I've seen it a number of times.
It's kind of one of those films that's part of, like, the cultural consciousness. Even if we haven't seen it, we kind of think we have.
Yeah. People who have never seen it, both of them, they still know, you know, that thus spake Zarathustra. Everyone knows, open the pod bay doors, HAL.
Yeah. And HAL.
Yeah. And everyone knows HAL. I mean, my God, the references to HAL. Every time it used to be you see a computer on screen in a movie or TV show, there would be some reference to HAL.
Yeah. And there may be a good reason for that as we head into the AI age, but we'll come back to that. I think this week's talk about the acting is going to be, what's the word I want? Brief.
Yeah.
Because this is not an actor's movie.
There are no names. No. I'm sorry, there's no names in this movie. Who do we have this? Gary Lockwood, who Mike knows.
It's Gary Mitchell. No, watch out for his shiny eyes. Oh.
That's right. From what was supposed to be the first, that was supposed to be the first episode of Star Trek, right? Even though it wasn't shown first.
It was the
I'm not talking about the pilot with the, what's his face?
It is, from the second pilot. So the first pilot was The Cage, which was shot with a different, totally different cast, except for Majel Barrett and actually
Spock.
I think the guy who played Scotty's in there too somewhere, but
is he
in the background? But Spock and Number One, as played by Majel Barrett, are in that first pilot, but that didn't sell. Instead, they were like, yeah, we like your idea, but could you do something else, which never freaking happens. So they did the second pilot, which is why Where No Man Has Gone Before looks different. It's using a lot of the same stuff from the first pilot. And that has Gary Lockwood in it as Gary Mitchell, who makes things float. And has, what's her name, Kellerman, Sally Kellerman as, right-hand glowy eye lady person. So that's the only person I knew in this film.
I knew one other. And it's just a fluke that I do. And that was Leo Rossiter, who plays Dr. Andrei Smyslov.
Oh.
Who is there for, you know, moose and squirrel or some
space.
Moose and Squirrel in space going to push out the airlock.
What do you know him from?
I know him from an old British sitcom called The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin. He played Reggie Perrin.
Oh, see, I only...
He also...
I only know him from looking a lot like Ralph Fiennes, but other than
that... oddly enough, he was also in another movie that came out that same year, and the one that did win Best Picture, Oliver.
Oh, yeah, we're going to be talking about that. He's a
small part. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the actors in this, honestly... Probably the most interesting one is the guy who does the voice of Hal, which is a guy named Douglas Rain.
Mm. I mean, Ed Bishop is in there. I didn't recognize him. He's from UFO as Ed Straker. That's not a cool like hero name, although he's not really a hero character.
Howitzer explosion guy.
Everybody in there has like either no lines at all or like next to nothing. We get probably Keir D'Elia and Gary Lockwood the most because they're the two. They're the
Bowman and Poole.
Yeah, I don't know who plays the meat popsicles that we've got. If it's anybody, I'm
not sure if they even got credited.
I wouldn't think so. But it is. Boy, is this not an actor's movie?
No,
I think that they do fine. I think like they're not meant to be. They're almost all. It's almost like everyone in here is an everyman, and there are lots of different ways we could have gotten way off track. So for when. Dr. Floyd shows up, we could have had a whole subplot about how the government is hiding things and stuff, because they basically find not only evidence of extraterrestrial life, but that it had left us a little present 4 million years ago on the moon.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, but that's not what this is about, so I get it.
By the way, the anthropological science in this is sound. If this was 4 million years ago, that is when that's the rise of Australopithecus africanus.
Well, and one of the
would have been the right timing.
One of the things that I did know about trivia is that a lot of people didn't think that the people who did the makeup effects in this film should have been recognized for any kind of award because they thought it was actual trained monkeys or trained apes. It would be because monkeys have tails. Amongst
by the way, things. that was a real leopard.
Yeah, I know.
Jumping on the guy,
but you see its eyes glowing. That leopard was a replicant. I'm telling you.
Oh yeah. You didn't give it a void comp test. You don't know for sure.
Meow.
Yeah. They actually went and got a leopard from the Southampton Zoo, and they trained it to play fight on the set.
Yeah, sure. You want to be that guy?
Yeah.
I don't.
No!
My monkey costume will save me.
Yeah, the trainer neck was like standing there ready to tackle the animal, and everyone is like, I'm going to die, aren't I? I'm going to be eaten on this movie.
Yeah.
And Kubrick is going, don't worry about it, don't worry about it.
Leopards are scary. They kill animals as big or bigger than them, and then they drag them up trees.
Yeah.
Because backwards. Yeah, they're
dangerous, dangerous creatures.
Yeah, so I vote no on the leopard.
They're pretty much the only animal we see with the ape men, except for a bunch of...
Okapi.
I don't know, tapirs? Capybara?
Capybara is a rodent and lives in South America. Yeah. I believe they're okapi, but don't quote me on that.
Okay.
Yeah. And they're amazingly calm around people.
Just, yeah.
Like, so at the point, there's one of them shoving one out of the way, and I was like, yeah, whatever. Like, you're a herd animal. You're hoofstock. Don't you, like, get... skittish and run away? They didn't.
Well, I think part of the idea is they didn't. The Australos hadn't realized that they could eat them yet.
I mean,
until they figure out how to use, until they seize the bone. There's a deeper.
No, you were going to bring that up. Yeah, don't watch Jack the Giant Killer. There was a weird part of that because it wasn't like they instantly were made into omnivores. I'm sure that they ate. Carrion, right? Because there's no way that they would just suddenly be able to eat meat.
Probably not. I'm sure they would have found something.
Yeah.
But the photography in that sequence is gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's just beautiful shots. That was in Namibia, by the way.
Okay, I was wondering if you'd find out. I'm pretty sure it was Africa somewhere, but...
Yeah, yeah. Most of the rest is filmed, like, on the Isle of Man. Although, did you recognize when Dave is going through his... oh, God, poppies, poppies, poppies sequence.
Slit scan, yeah.
And he's flying over what looks like a colorized photo negative.
Yeah.
I know there's a name for that effect. I don't know what it is.
It looked like it was solarization, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah. Did it look familiar?
No.
That was Monument Valley.
Oh. Well, I've only been to the very southern part, but yeah.
But Monument Valley shows up in a lot of movies.
Mostly Westerns. Well, I mean, let's face it. This is Kubrick. The photography's going to be gorgeous. That's one of his mainstays.
It's beautiful to look at.
And everything's going to be very, very tightly controlled. That being said, this is probably the coldest his actor. Well, you know, I just recently saw
Barry Lyndon.
I just recently saw Barry Lyndon, and I won't say that there was a lot of passion in that, although there was some humor, which I was not expecting. But Kubrick is known for very exacting approaches to his films. When we did the first episode of this show,
Eyes Wide Shut,
we found out there was something like, 100 and some odd takes for one particular scene. Because he just couldn't get it the way he wanted it. And so what you're going to see is, and it was shot for Cinerama, which I had forgotten. I've only been by the Cinerama Dome. I've never seen a film in Cinerama. But it was meant to be a spectacle. And in some ways, besides the drugs, it was. But I guess we're done with the actors. There's not really any point.
Yeah, there's not much to say about them. The film is really three segments.
Yes.
Four, if you really want to stretch it, but... It's the Dawn of Man sequence with the Australopithecus.
Yep.
It's the space travel one with Reggie Perrin and company. And it's Bowman and Poole's trip with Hal to Jupiter.
Yeah, with an intermission thrown in.
Yes, there's an intermission because this movie is 2.5 hours long.
Which
nowadays, I mean, there was an intermission in Dune 2, I can tell you that.
No.
And that's more than 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
Is a thing they used to do that. And a lot of the long ones. Gone with the Wind has one. Dr. Zhivago, I think, has one.
Both of them are like
Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah. I want a question for you. I actually wrote this down. Do you think it needed it?
I don't think so. I've seen it in the theaters a couple of times. I don't remember feeling the need to get up and walk around after an hour and a half.
No, I used it. Like, it's like, you're going to do that? Well, I guess I will pee, but I didn't feel like, usually they do that because you need a moment to digest, you know, the burning of Atlanta or the freezing of Russia or whatever they did in Dr. Vago. And also there's usually some sort of themic reason, like we're about to change something big is going to be different. Mm-hmm. And here,
time shift, costumes, whatever.
Yeah. And here it was sort of in the middle of something. It was sort of oddly placed. And it wasn't halfway through. It was like 90 minutes into the film. There was suddenly an intermission, and it's 2.5. It's like, okay. So I don't know. I wonder if it was something that the studio
thought. I think it might have been the theaters.
Maybe. It wasn't common, but it wasn't that crazy. 2.5 hours. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was in there because of that original. You said they cut out another 18 minutes or something. Closer to 3.
19, yeah.
I don't know. I am very sorry that they made him cut out the post-credit sequence, because that's always...
Yes, that's right. Very, the monolith breaks open, and another one of the ape men climbs out.
You know, it's funny, I never thought about this, but, you know, often films will keep a little record of their outtakes, because some of them are fun, and they share them. Mm-hmm. I can't picture anyone laughing on this set. Like, it just...
There is one joke in this entire movie, according to Kubrick.
And I missed it that way.
And I missed it because it's some sign for the zero-G toilet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that
on the Discovery. That is the only intentional joke in this 2.5-hour movie. There is no humor here.
Well, there isn't humor on purpose, but we will. This is the source of See You Next Wednesday.
Yes.
Did you catch that? Yes,
but... I did.
Yeah, see our episode. What the heck did it show? American Werewolf in London? No, we didn't do that, did we?
No, we didn't do that one. I think it was it Animal House?
Animal House. It was Animal House.
Yeah.
Because somewhere, John, what's his name?
Landis
always puts in a film or reference to See You Next Wednesday, and it's from this
film. And it's from there.
Yeah. Boy, where to start? My first note is, space is big, space is dark. It's hard to find.
It's hard to find
a place to park.
Yep.
I think that blank opening with just the music playing must have been really awkward for audiences. Like,
yeah. I even when I was watching it this time, I'm like, uh-oh. Has something gone wrong with the picture?
Same here. However, that music... to me, really sets the mood. It's a very odd, I don't know what that music is, but it's very strange and otherworldly.
I believe it's either the chorale part of Thus Spake Zarathustra, or it's this weird chorale version of the Requiem,
which is
in that movie. There's a bunch of Strauss. You got the Blue Danube Waltz, too. Which is, honestly, a lot of people, I think it was their first introduction to the Blue Danube Waltz.
Oh, I'm pretty sure it's in at least one Warner Brothers cartoon.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a Daffy Duck.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
But it's, yeah, it is one of those, because there's no credits or anything, right? He just wants you to go right into the film. So, and I think being disoriented is a major part of this film. I love that quote you gave us. It's like, if you fully understand this, we haven't done our job.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that part too. I do have a couple of questions though. So we see the dawn of man. We see Australia, but that was stuff. We see those ape people doing ape law and stuff. And there's a monolith. And obviously it is meant to have appeared overnight because they go to sleep and it's not there, and they wake up and they're all uptight and ooking. What happened to that?
Apparently the Australopithecus built a spaceship and took it to the moon and buried it there.
I really don't think that's what the movie's implying.
Assuming it's the same one, basically it showed up, did its job, which was to inspire them, and then disappeared and appeared on the moon.
See, I didn't think it was a separate one. I just was still like,
I wasn't sure.
Maybe over 4 million years it would have turned to something. Apart, I don't know. Because we don't even really know what it is. And here,
nothing, we have no idea.
Here's my question. Because my feeling is that the monoliths are either giving us gentle nudges or they're meant to be like a trail of breadcrumbs.
I think it's partly that. I think they are a kind of evolutionary nudge.
Well,
at least initially. And then the second one, it sends out a signal to Jupiter and we go, well, we're following the signal.
Well, and we're going to come to that too, because there's a couple of questions I have about that. So my feeling is the monolith doesn't teach Australopithecus to kill things. It teaches them to use tools.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm not saying it's a war machine. I'm saying it shows them, it gives them the next step in evolution, which is tool use.
Well, and the thing is I can totally see why the interpretation could have been otherwise, that, oh, these aliens taught us to be killers. And it's like, well, if you kind of look at our behavior before that thing teaches us to seize the bone, then we're not exactly all getting along that well, because we want that puddle of water, goddammit, which must taste great.
Oh, God, yeah.
Stagnant.
Yeah, I got a bunch of our copy pooping in it, probably. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
I do have to admit, when the Australopithecus wake up and see the monolith, I have in my notes, well, there's something you don't see every day. Ook, what's that, Ock? A big black monolith in the rocks. Oh, I don't know.
Thank you, Rocky and Bullwinkle, because that and Robot Monster at the center of everything. I got to say, when we get to space, this is perhaps it's definitely the first and probably, sadly, the last time that space sequences would be silent.
Yeah, which make perfect sense, because it's a vacuum, there's no noise.
No.
And let us face it, this looks amazing, especially for 1968.
Yep.
This was the first science fiction movie that really wanted to make things look realistic.
Yeah.
Let's face it, most of the early science fiction, all the way up through the 60s, they didn't really care as much if you saw the string or the zipper on the costume.
Well, now wait, Ed Wood didn't care.
A lot of them didn't. I mean, you get a few like this Island Earth where they try to do things, but you can tell they're, okay, we know it's a matte painting. We know you know it's a matte painting. This, they went all out. By the way, this movie held the record at the time for the most effects shot, 250.
Oh, boy.
To give you an idea, less than 10 years later, Star Wars would come out with 350.
Yeah, I'm surprised it was...
Contrast that with Revenge of the Sith, which is 2,200.
And a lot of CG in that one, so...
Yeah.
And the influence it would have on science fiction films still can't be measured, because we're talking right after we're going to talk about UFO, Space 1999, oh boy, Space 1999.
Oh,
Star Wars, Silent Running, Alien, pretty much
Close
anything.
Encounters of the Third Kind, everything. And say what you want. I mean, we're I assume, going to talk some about the movie that did win Best Picture and how this didn't even get nominated.
Yeah, we'll get there.
how much of a cultural impact did Oliver have versus this movie?
Oliver who?
Peep. Yeah. Cousin Oliver.
I think you mean Oliver, because doesn't it have
yes.
the...
Yes.
Yeah. Just yes, like McClintock. Yes.
McCloud. And Hail Caesar. Yeah, I don't want to leave the effects too quickly, but we probably should. The effects are astonishing. But yes, this movie, people who have never seen it know, open the pod bay doors, Hal. It has, hell, last year's big hit, the Barbie movie, mm-hmm. starts with a tribute to 2001.
Yep, the little girls and their dolls.
With Barbie, yeah, with the dolls and Barbie herself as the monolith.
Yeah.
Like, it hasn't stopped.
Yeah, it was only, what, 56 you know, years ago?
Less than six, just a little less than 60 years, and people, it is still everywhere. Mm. Whenever any, in a cheap movie, if they want to do a big reveal, they always play Thus Spake Zarathustra.
Yeah.
Because it's public domain and you can.
Yeah, well, there you go. And there's other things in here, like there's a little video call that Dr. Floyd has to his daughter or to the daughter of Kubrick.
Yeah.
And that feels so much like the vidphone sequence in Blade Runner that it's not even funny. That has mm-hmm. to be a nod. There's a bunch of the way that Blade Runner looks is paying tribute to this. So it's so rare that you will get a single film that everyone basically goes, oh, yeah, we're going to do it like that. Like, oh, you solved that problem. Okay, cool. Now we've got it. And just keeps mm-hmm. going 60 years later. It's nuts. But, yeah. And the space shots are gorgeous. And as it turned out, we'd find out a year later, oh, that's what it really looks like. Because,
yeah,
you know, we'd been in space, but we hadn't been, like, to a place before. We hadn't been to the moon. And it's like, yeah, except for the low, you know, video quality, that's what it mm-hmm. looks like. So, yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah, lots of. And the sets themselves must have cost an absolute fortune. Like when Floyd first gets to the space station, he's just walking down the hall. It could have been a hall. We wouldn't have thought twice about it, but it's like, no, it's curved at both ends because it's mm-hmm. on a round space station. And it's one shot. Like they kind of use it later on, but it's like they built that whole raised. I don't know what they.
The sets are incredible. You can see where the money went, because clearly it didn't go for hiring big-name actors. It went for the effects, for the sets, and for the design.
Yeah, I don't know how much they paid Clark for this, too, because you kind of can't call this an adaptation, because he was writing the novel while he was writing the script. So,
yeah.
Weird.
And Clark was not that big a name yet. He was a name in science fiction, but outside of science fiction circles, nobody knew who he was.
Well, I'm not even sure he ever got that big in like a household name or anything, but he was certainly known for this. Probably Stranger in the Strange Lands is his biggest one.
That's Heinlein.
Oh, that's right, Heinlein. Well, no, at least I read it.
This Rendezvous with Rama, Children of the Stars. Sure. 2010, 3001.
Yeah, let's get that right out of the way. This film did not need a sequel. Nope.
No, it really did not, and the sequel shows that.
And Clark's in it, which is interesting. Yes. It's whatever.
Good for him for making money, but we didn't need that.
No.
And I'm glad they never tried to, they have not yet tried to film the third one.
That's right, there is a third one.
3001, yeah. It's a trilogy.
And, have you read the book? I haven't read the book.
I have. I read the first two books.
How was the first one?
It was interesting. It doesn't help, but it's interesting.
How's the second one? Is it like the movie?
I don't remember anything about the second one.
The movie, I enjoyed it at the time, but it's just, it's so made by other people. It's not even funny.
Yeah, it is not Kubrickian at all.
It's not challenging. It's not, it's okay, but it's not, A couple of
there's a lot that doesn't get spelled out in this movie. A lot is left to the audience.
No, but some of the stuff that is spelled out, I actually have a question on.
Yeah.
Why does Dave need a pod? He's going to do a spacewalk on part of the ship. Why doesn't he just go out and, I don't know, walk on the ship?
Because, back then especially, they didn't know how dangerous that was. Mm. It's incredibly dangerous. If you fall off, you better hope your safety tether holds, and it might not, because you are never going to come back.
But he does it anyway. And then he parks really far away. Like, did he need a handicap plate or something? I mean...
Yeah, that part I'm not sure, but knowing them, they worked out some kind of reasoning for it.
It just felt weird. And then when he and Frank find out, Dave and Frank find out that something's weird with Hal, and I do want to come back to Hal, he rotates the pod. so yeah. that the window's now facing the camera. Why
yeah, that I didn't get either. Why didn't they were perfectly safe initially. I don't get that. I also have to say they lose their trust of Hal very fast. He makes one mistake, and they're like, oh, boy, I don't know.
Well, here's the thing, and I definitely can understand that. He's in charge of everything. Yeah. Everything. And he's there. They say there's never been a mistake. And so, and when they confront him with it as softly as they do, he's like, gee, I don't know how that happened. Well, why
it must be human error.
Yeah, it must be your fault. Why don't you go put it back and we'll wait for it to fail and find out why I thought it was going to. Yeah, that sounds great. I, at that point, I'd be sure like, yeah, that's a great idea. You want to go get something in the totally enclosed bathroom with no cameras for a second? Sure, I'll go with you. I had no problem with that. The thing that I found confusing is... It turns out Hal seems to think that, or the astronauts seem to think there's a piece of information that Hal doesn't know, and that's the problem. What it turns out is that there's a piece of information they don't know.
Yeah.
And Hal, I guess, does. He has access to it. He's supposed to show them this video clip when they get to Jupiter. Although, why they weren't told, I don't know.
That's the thing. What they would have had time to come to grips with it. They could have come up with theories. These guys are scientists. These aren't like lunkheads that you threw into space.
No. So I found some of that felt, and this is weird for this film and for a Kubrick film, some of it felt plot contrivancy to me.
Most of it didn't bother me because the rest of it, there's so much of the rest of it you cannot take literally because you don't know what the hell it is.
Well, that comes later. I just have to say, I'm not even sure that the whole subplot of Hal... is a good choice.
Huh. Really? Because that's the character everyone remembers, and honestly, I think Hal is the most interesting character in the movie.
Well, and that's the problem, is that he's... The whole film is about extraterrestrial potentially meddling in human evolution, right? Yeah. That's what the whole film's about. But now we're going to take this side trip into AI, but we're not really going to explore it. We're going to touch on it. We're going to bring up some interesting points, but then we're going to go and meet up with the big box of cereal that's floating in space, and we're going to turn into Cocoa Puffs. And, of course, I never even thought about this before, but in a way, this film kind of dovetails into AI. And I don't mean, like, this the idea of AI. I mean the film that he was supposed to do and didn't. Spielberg finished it.
I guess.
Because part of the problem, and here's where I actually understand... Hal's motivation here is they start acting strangely, and I can't tell if he actually set up that failure thing as a test. It's like, are you guys totally with the mission? Maybe I should, let's just see what these guys do. Oh, now they're threatening to kill me. I don't want to be killed. Because he says, Hal, in that interview, Hal says he's conscious. He considers himself conscious, which is, how much different is that than being alive?
Yeah, that's a big question. No, that's a strange part, and it's unfortunate they don't get to do more with it. It does feel like it's a separate story.
It never occurred to me before, but watching it for this show, honestly, I think only the second time I've seen the entire film, I'm like, this doesn't really go anywhere. It's fun, it's interesting, it adds some tension, because otherwise there's been, none.
Yeah, we have to have a villain, in effect, and Hal becomes the villain.
Or conflict of some sort.
Yeah.
So
there's no antagonist otherwise.
Yeah, it was just, it felt oddly unconsidered for Kubrick to me, that we enter this argument and then we just sort of leave it alone. We don't play with it. So, yeah.
Interesting. I want to talk a little about the pacing.
By all means, because I have this feeling we're not going to agree.
The pacing is very languid in this. And I remember the previous times I watched it, it really drove me nuts how slow it is. I gotta say, it doesn't bother me as much.
Me either. Like, when the intermission popped up, I'm like, how far? We're into this over 90 minutes? Wow.
That was the thing. Was I would check the time every so often, and I'm like, oh God, it's probably only been 10 minutes. Been 45? Really?
Yeah. I found it really interesting. It's just a bunch of guys in monkey suits, but, you know, what's going on? We're here for a reason. What's going to happen? Okay, this group doesn't like that group, and obviously we like this group because they've been shoved out away from the puddle. But then the monolith shows up. What does that mean? I guess the word's intrigued. I was intrigued. Mm. And when we get to space flight, one of my favorite parts is like, oh, yeah, space flight, whatever. I'm going to take a nap. This is boring. Because we've got to that point. Although I think both Clark and Kubrick were a little optimistic as how soon that was going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Never mind.
They were also kind of optimistic as to how long Pan Am Airlines would last. I was
going to say the same thing. Never mind Bell, because we don't have that anymore either.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the pacing when they're in space works really well because it emphasizes the sheer scale that they're working on. Mm. Like, yes, it's going to take... By the way, they got the numbers right, too, when they say the half a billion mile journey to Jupiter. Jupiter's like 556 million miles away from Earth. They're right.
Yeah. That seems like something I can't imagine Kubrick wouldn't have found out. But
yeah, they looked a lot of that up. But
the only thing I wonder is, so you were ready to go like 18 months?
We don't know how long it took them to have the thing set up or whatever.
Well, I say 18 months.
Yeah, but did they? Yeah, we don't know if they had the ship built already or they were going to use it for something else.
Hope so, because it's huge.
Yeah, it is enormous.
Even the miniature was 72 feet long.
Wow. Yeah,
it's huge. Mm. So we should quickly get to that weird sequence at the end. This is the part that everyone either remembers.
This is where everyone pops their mushrooms.
And I just want to know what your theory is of what happens at the end when he meets the third monolith, Dave Bowman.
Well, part of it, I think, is it's another form of forcible evolution. He is pushed through time and through space. He sees what's coming. He sees what he could be. And then he becomes the next step in evolution, the Star Child.
Do you think that...
That's as far as I've got. I have no real idea. We're not supposed to know.
Do you think that it's meant to, in any way, signify the melding of human and alien?
No. I don't think so. I think the aliens are keeping out of it. That's why the Star Child looks almost entirely human.
And also looks like Dave Bowman, quite honestly.
Yeah,
it does.
Kind of does.
I never noticed that before.
They modeled the head. They modeled the face on the actors.
Yeah.
That is true. That's pretty much as far as I got. What about you? What did you think happened?
I mean, I would have titled the end of the film The Birth of Understanding or something like that. It felt like Dave was being fed history and the alien journey up to that point, like to the point where he was kind of going catatonic. It's like, I can't process all this recalculating. And I always kind of wondered if it wasn't meant to be a bridge between human and alien evolution. And it opens up a bunch of really interesting questions, like why are they doing this? And how could they see so far into the future that they would need to do this and what they would need to do to get the results they wanted? And I, in that respect, I have no problem with the vagary of the ending and agree that Clark is like, you shouldn't know everything because we don't know, we never see the aliens. We know nothing about them.
That was apparently a big point of contention. The studio wanted them to have the aliens physically show up. Mm. And both, I think Clark and Kubrick debated it for a while and they both said, no.
Yeah.
That we can't do that.
It wouldn't have helped. It wouldn't have done. It's like when they had a special edition of Close Encounters the next year, and we got to go inside the mothership. It's like, I don't want to go inside.
Didn't add anything.
No,
didn't
you're add making anything. Concrete something that was much more a product of wonder. And I think that that's as trippy and weird, and some might see it as indulgent, as that weird ending was in 2001. I think part of it is meant to make us off kilter and to realize that there's going to be stuff that we're going to come across that we literally can't understand, not initially.
Yeah.
And it looks to me like that whole sequence where he sees himself growing older and eventually dying is what it takes for him to encapsulate what information has been shoved into his head. And I think the way he does it is very artful. It's literally like he's looking forward to himself looking back at different moments that he recalls finishing his life in this space apartment. I don't know. Again, we're not meant to understand it, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But before we get... Should we get to the end, or should we and talk about Oliver after that? I guess that's what we do. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we do. The finish.
So, Max.
Yep.
You don't remember the first time you saw it.
I don't. I know I saw it in a theater, and I know I've gone to at least one midnight show of it. And by the way, when people tell you, oh, you know what you got to do to go to a midnight show and get stoned? No, you should not, because you will fall asleep. That is what happened to me. This was many years ago. I was young, I was spry, and I was...
What? You were a beautiful young lady.
Yes, I was. I was a lovely young lady.
Getting high at the theater.
Fit as a lass and brown as a nut. I don't know. Barefoot with cheeks of tan. Yeah. And it's not... I don't know about seeing it on hallucinogens. I cannot speak to that, and I wouldn't really want to try. No. But I can tell you, don't do it stoned. The movie will appear to be 45 hours long.
Yeah. But what did you think this time? Because you had to rewatch it for the show, right?
I did. I got to say, I liked it better this time. Mm-hmm. Because when the first couple times, I was like, oh my God, this is so slow.
Yeah.
It's like, I have to wait so long. I always loved the sequence with Hal. I still find that whole thing where he is, in that expressionless, passionless voice, begging for his life. Mm-hmm.
It's very chilling.
And it's chilling, and it's sad. Like, my mind is going. There's no question about it. I can feel it. I'm afraid.
Mm. But even you put more emotion into it than the actor did.
Than he does.
Which is
on purpose. And that singing, Daisy. People do, that's another thing people reference. Even people who haven't seen the movie know that.
Yeah. Well, and that interesting bit you brought up about the first computer synthesized voice song.
That was that song.
It totally makes an extra point there. Like, we're hearkening back to our own history of computer AI science stuff. So,
What about you? When was the first time you saw it?
No idea. Again, it's one of those things, being a science fiction fan as a kid, I knew of it.
It's just something you took in through your skin.
Yeah. Like, I had the soundtrack album, which was a bad choice because I thought, oh, this will be cool. And it's just classical music. So it didn't appeal to me as a kid at all. Mm-hmm. But I knew the special effects shots. I knew about Hal. I think the first time I actually sat through it, there was a summer film program going on in Boston at the Wang Theater, and they were showing big films that needed to be seen on a big screen, like Wizard of Oz and this, and I saw it during that.
Oh, that's a good way to see it.
Yeah, except I think I actually went the evening after a 24-hour science fiction film marathon.
Oh,
so I went home after staying up 24 hours, slept for a few hours, then went into Boston and watched it, and I'm not sure if I slept at all during the film. I might have, and my impression then when I was younger was like yours. It was very long, and I was wondering if this was going to work, but this time I was fascinated. I really thought that 90 minutes went by quickly. I was really surprised, and it's Kubrick. It's very, very well plotted out. It's not about the actors. In a way, it's not even about the human condition. It's literally about something outside the human condition and what that impact might have on us, because let's face it, we're still not ready for it. I have no problem with the ending being unanswered questions, unlike certain other films we may have watched recently, which literally made us go, wait, am I missing a reel? What happened? But the big question is, that year it wasn't even somehow was not even nominated for Best Picture. Even if it was not going to win because people were just not ready for it. But what did win, as you pointed out, was Oliver, film
we... Who will buy this wonderful morning?
Which we covered in our 82nd episode, almost more than 200 episodes ago.
And I got to say, I liked Oliver. And I went back and I listened to our episode. We liked it. It's a fine musical. It's very standard. I mean, apart from the fact that it's set in an unbelievably brutal, horrible setting.
Because you know what says musical comedy better than Dickens? Gee, I don't know.
Hey, think about it. A lot of these great musicals, Sound of Music is The Rise of the Nazis. South Pacific, World War II's going on and people are dying. Oklahoma, Poor Judd is Dead is a song trying to induce a guy to commit suicide. There's a lot of darkness in these classic musicals. Don't tell me all fluffy kittens and unicorns.
Oh, it's not all, but you'd like to think that there was some And the only thing that's like bright and cheery about Oliver is that he escapes.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're almost the Tears of a Clown level here, and let's put that to music, so whatever. You liked it better than I did. I thought that the lead, the kid who played Mark something, was terrible.
Lester.
Yeah, he was not awful.
Good. But there was a lot of other good stuff in it.
And let's face it, which is a more lasting impact on
the culture? That's the thing. Every so often, someone will mention one of the songs from Oliver. Maybe. I don't know anyone who quotes the lines from it, and there is nothing on the equivalent of Open the Pod Bay Doors, Hal, or I'm Sorry, Dave, I Can't Do That. Or this movie is 2001 is iconic. Mm. And the reasons, I'm not sure why it didn't get, well, I have some ideas why it didn't get nominated. First off, it's science fiction. Right. The Academy does not like genre pictures.
Nope.
It does not like science. It really doesn't like science fiction. Nope. Occasionally a Western or a romance will get in.
Well, those aren't genres. Those are Hollywood.
Yeah. But they do not like science fiction. And people don't like Kubrick. Kubrick was challenging. He made a lot of enemies.
Yeah. He also made a lot of amazing films.
He did.
And let's face it, this is an amazing film. Even if you don't like it, the look of the film, the breadth of the film.
It is unique. I mean, especially for its time, it's unbelievable.
I mean, they invented processes just for this film. That weird light thing in the end, I think, was called slit scan, and it was brand new for that film. Ooh. And, you know, what did Oliver invent? Urchins?
Pickpocketing?
Yeah, there's nothing.
Oliver Reed? I don't know. Nothing.
No. So, yeah, if it had been part of the pack, I would definitely have picked this well over Oliver. And it's Max liked it better than I did. It's fine, but it's nothing.
It's a solid musical. It's nothing innovative about it. No. There's nothing new. This was groundbreaking. Yeah,
very much so in a lot of ways. And science fiction still owes residuals to this because of their looks.
Yes.
Yeah. I've been watching a show called The Expanse. Yes. The space, I mean, to be fair, Kubrick was also trying to base his space on some of the things that had been proposed for NASA and stuff. But
still.
But what else we have still is we still want answers to a poll question. And Max, could you give us that poll question and how people could answer it?
Yes, I will tell you right now with my words that I am saying at this very moment.
Forgot, did you?
Line?
Chris and Honey, we're shooting.
Do you think the bias against genre movies like science fiction or Westerns is unfair, or do you think it's right for award nominations to go to mostly so-called real movies?
With EE or EA?
Yes. And you can answer this by going to our website, maxmikemovies.com, and leaving a comment. You can email us at us@maxmikemovies.com. You can find us on the back face.
Facebook. It's called Facebook. Puss,
whatever. But he said, under Max Mike Movies. And of course, we are on all the podcast apps, on all your favorite podcasting monoliths. We are everywhere.
Just touch us.
We're over there behind. Don't touch us.
Touch us to learn things.
But we are not done. We're maybe about halfway through.
We're well past halfway. We've only got two more to go.
Didn't win. Yeah. So we got another one. If only there was someone who could tell us what we're going to watch next week.
Sure, it could be you.
Who could tell us?
Perhaps me.
No, that's not it. Who could tell us? Mike, what are we watching?
I think we're going to continue in the lines of not only didn't win, but wasn't nominated. Oh. And it's very much a case of, really? Because there are some films you're like, oh, I'm sure just lost to something else. It's like, nope, wasn't even up there. And this one, we're going to take a step back time-wise. We're going to go back in time. Back to the yesteryear of 1952, and a certain film that probably still continues to delight audiences to this day, lost to a film that, shall we say, doesn't continue to delight audiences to this day, and that is the strangely overlooked Singin' in the Rain.
Oh, good Lord, it wasn't even nominated?
I don't believe it was.
Oh, wow.
It was, however, thwarted by the behemoth that was the greatest show on earth.
Oh, God.
Oh, have you seen
that
it?
That one that, oh, I have. I and it's very...
Lucky you.
And it's very much a, oh, God, Cecil B. DeMille's about to die. Give him an Oscar for something.
Now, is that fair? We don't know that for sure, because we're going to have... Well, you've already seen it. I'm going to have to watch two films next week, although, to be fair, Singing in the Rain, how many times have I seen that? Oops, spoiler.
Yeah, but Greatest Show on Earth is long.
Yeah, I know. Well, so was this, and it had an intermission. So, yeah, next week, we are going to watch Singing in the Rain. We'll have Max and Mike and less singing.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.